for the next hundreds of years, this is the world we have. Yeah. And in that world, this bittersweetness and this existential longing, I believe, is one of our great superpowers.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today, we welcome my dear friend, Susan Cain. She's author of a wonderful book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, which was a really big game changer for a lot of introverts who felt as though their unique gifts were not appreciated in a world that is catered towards extroverts. Her most recent book is called Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Make Us Whole. And really like this new book as well. Her new book touches on lots of really important topics that aren't often discussed, such as the complex emotion of bittersweet and an idea that she refers to as existential longing, which I really like. I've known Susan for quite some years, and I remember when she was working on this book, we would have lots of text chats about existential longing and how it's strongly tied to things like creativity and human connection and spirituality. So it's really always a delight to talk to Susan, and today is no exception. I hope you enjoy our chat as much as we did. So without further ado, I bring you Susan Cain. I am very proud of you. I am very proud of you, Susan. And I love how you bring such soul and emotional depth to your writing and thinking. And thinking. I think we need that in the world today. There's a lot of thinking that somehow the idea is that, well, if it's properly reasoned, we've stripped out all of the emotional depth from it. And I don't think that's quite right.
I agree. That's actually such an interesting idea, because I do think, even from an intellectual point of view, we now understand that the emotions are just as important, if not more so, than our ability to reason. And yet, in the way that academic ideas get discussed, there is still a feeling of the cognitive thought process being above the heart and soul. And maybe a suspicion that the heart and soul is based on flimsy intuition and not on hard evidence, let's say.
Yeah, but you show these things can be integrated, and sometimes you just have to show people a better way. Okay, so this new book, Bittersweetness, is such a complex emotion, isn't it? It's not just like a palette of colors where you're only just combining two and then out pops something. I feel like the bittersweetness combines like thousands.
Yeah, it's like all of them. Combines them all.
Oh my gosh, all of them. Not even thousands, but all of them.
Which I guess would then say that we end up with brown, right? Like a big muddy brown, but I don't think that is where we end up.
Is that true that if you combine all the colors, brown is what comes out?
I think so. I'm no visual artist, but I think that's true. I didn't know that. Or maybe black, I don't know.
Well, black seems somehow appropriate for bittersweetness, but in a way that I feel like you're arguing that the black that comes out is actually beautiful. Like, you're not saying like it's not black, but you're saying it's beautiful. It's like like when you look at it, you're like, wow, there's so much here that can be fodder for so much of the goodness of humanity.
Yeah, I am saying that. I'm saying that bittersweetness is one of the great gateways that we have to creativity, to connection, mm-hmm. to love. Mm-hmm. And that we're living in a culture that tells us not to talk about these things so much. And that is to our great detriment. You know, that's like not using one of the great powers that we have. And maybe we should define what bittersweetness is for people who are listening and haven't read the book yet. I don't know.
Sure. Well, I feel like that's no fun.
Oh, okay. We'll do it. Let's do it your way, SPK.
Let's be poetic about it. If you've ever wondered why you like sad music, if others have ever called you an old soul, if you find comfort or inspiration in a rainy day, if you react intensely to music, art, nature, and beauty, if you've ever wondered why creativity seems to be associated with sorrow, longing, and transcendence, then you know what the definition of bittersweetness is.
I love it. I love it. I love it.
I don't know. Are people, I hope to be, that was, I don't know. I tried something new there, but do you want to define precisely what it's so funny. We just reversed roles. Wait a minute. What just happened? You're like, Scott, shouldn't I give the scientific definition? And I was like, whoa, Susan, let me be poetic. Let me.
Yeah, and I will say, speaking of the scientific definition, that some of those questions that SBK just read to you come from a quiz that that he and the great psychologist David Yeadon and I worked on together. It's in a very preliminary form, and it's in at the start of the Bittersweet book, and it helps you kind of assess where you are on this bittersweet spectrum, how likely you are to find yourself in states of bittersweetness, which I would define as being the recognition that joy and sorrow and light and dark, bitter and sweet, are forever paired, a kind of acute awareness of passing time. And then also with all of that, a curiously piercing joy at the beauty of the world, which when we're in those states of bittersweetness, we feel very intensely.
Yeah. And it's the music is such a great example of this. Some of my favorite cello sonatas are in E minor. For some reason, E minor just strikes the core of my soul, strikes to the core of my soul. I love E minor. And it's a sad, ostensibly sad, yet joyful key. It's hard to describe.
Yeah. And did you always wonder about it? I mean, it's actually because of that experience that I started going down this path in the first place. Like at first I wasn't thinking, no, not E minor, but minor key music in general for me. Like I didn't at first know I was going to be writing a book about a bittersweet construct. All I really wanted to do was answer the question of why it was that minor key music elicited the reactions in me and in many other people that it does. You know, and it's a reaction that philosophers sometimes call the paradox of tragedy. Like, why is it that something that is ostensibly tragic or sorrowful or is a minor key, you know, like dissonant and unresolved, why is it that those states would elicit in us feelings of joy and uplift and communion and transcendence? That's what I was trying to figure out. Like I saw it happening in music. So at first I was just answering that narrow question, but it became a much bigger project of how all these states are connected.
Who uses the phrase happy melancholy to describe those states? I saw that in quotes in your book, but who calls it that? You're the one.
So that actually started, it was years ago, Gretchen Rubin, you know, who has the Happiness Project book and blog and so on. She asked me in her blog I can't remember exactly what the question was, but it was something like, what is your favorite form of happiness or something like that? And again, this was long before I'd written this book. And I said, it's the state that I would call the happiness of melancholy. Which I've just for so long been intrigued by. And I might have actually called this book The Happiness of Melancholy, except I was told by, you know, agents and publishers and people who care about the success of the book that the very word melancholy would drive people away. And so I couldn't use it. I use it in the book, but I couldn't use it as the title.
Well, melancholy all by itself. Yeah, go on.
No. You go ahead, and then I want to talk about melancholy and psychology. But what were you going to say?
Oh, that's what I want to talk about. Well, that's precisely what I want to talk about, because that's been linked to depression. And just melancholy, not happy melancholy, but just straight out melancholy has been correlated with depression.
Yeah, and this is the thing. I mean, if you look in mainstream psychology, there is not really any distinct, you could call it a correlation effectively. There's no distinction made between the state of melancholy that artists and writers have been talking about for thousands of years, versus depression. Like it's not really talked about, even though I think that many of us, like you with your E minor, reaction, we know what it is to experience melancholy in a productive and uplifting and even spiritual sense. And so I've found it very frustrating that in mainstream psychology, there's really no place to discuss this. I mean, there are, I would say, the the tender shoots of that discussion rising up now, but generally it hasn't been there.
Yeah, and that's really unfortunate. That's really unfortunate. Imagine a therapist who is familiar with your book and these ideas and science of it, and has a patient who is melancholic, and they say, "Great, let's build on that and figure out some way of integrating that emotion into your life that gives your life more depth and meaning."
Exactly.
Maybe that's more of what a coach does. But
no,
yeah. But why not?
Why should there be any distinction? And again, I'm not saying, and I'm sure you're not saying, that the psychologist should take a person who presents with clinical depression and say, "Great." Like, that's not the point.
We're talking about that emotion.
Right. And we're distinguishing the emotion from depression. And we're saying psychology needs to make that distinction. Yeah. Like, just to be super clear about it.
100% clear. Thank you. Thank you. I didn't want to get canceled, so I appreciate that. Canceled by psychology. That would be not a good canceling for me. No. Absolutely. So let's talk about some of the powers of a bittersweet, melancholic outlook. And I am very curious why our culture has been so blind to its value up to this point.
Yeah, I mean, so the powers, I'll kind of say this all at once, but it really needs some unpacking, for lack of a better word. It's kind of a cliche word. But the powers really do have to do with creativity for reasons that we can talk about, right? Not in the conventional sense in which people equate, sometimes, I think, falsely equate depression and creativity. That's not what I mean. But the powers have to do with creativity and with connection and communion and love. I believe what is really happening, we can see if we think about the experience that we've all had. When you look at something that you find almost unbearably beautiful, it could be a painting, work of art, it could be nature, it could be the child splashing in a rain puddle, whatever it is. And the feeling that you get sometimes where you cry at the sheer beauty of that thing. And all the way back in the year 500, Gregory Great called this feeling of crying in the face of beauty compunctio, which is the holy tears. And he described it as a kind of bittersweetness. And it's what you're crying at is the gap between the world that we long for. Like, that beauty represents the perfect and beautiful world, which all humans at their soul feel they've been banished from. It represents the gap between that world that we're still longing for, that Eden that we can't stop speaking of, and the world that we live in today. And that, maybe what I've said so far accounts only for the tears part and not the holy part of that phrase, holy tears, but what makes it holy is, and you can use that word literally or metaphorically, what makes it holy is the glimpsing that better world for that moment. It makes us reach for it and do everything we can to bridge, to narrow the gap between that world and the one that we're in. So it's the heart of our creative impulse. It's like the word longing, literally, its etymology means to grow longer, to reach for something. You're reaching for Eden. And that's why we create in the first place. And it's also the fact that we are all in this state of exile from Eden. We're all in that state together that gives us a kind of communion, because we all know it. We all know what it means. And it's the deepest part of ourselves.
Wow. It's quite a statement. I need to process everything you just said, because it's really quite profound, and there's so many layers to it, because it resonates a lot with the kind of creative mind we put forth in our book, Wired to Create. You know, that the creative person is deeply sensitive to the world and its meanings and its potential meanings and their ability to show the world what new ways and new interpretations and deeper complexities. And it does seem like when creativity is at its best, it's able to go deeper into a phenomenon or something that most of us just see the surface of.
Yeah.
does seem like that's the case. Yeah, in your TED Talk, you said a comment, something along the lines of like, and that's why we exalt or give such special status to musicians and artists. And that statement actually hit me different. Was there, there's a new phrase that what the kids are saying these days that hit me, right? Or something. It's like, I forget what the phrase is, but people were saying that on my Twitter timeline recently, and I had to Google it. Hit me. Okay. Emotionally kind of hits you in a different way, because I've long wondered, like, why do we exalt artists and musicians? Why do we put them above on a pedestal above like doctors? And that used to bother me. It used to be like, I feel like doctors should kind of, they should be the ones we kind of put on the, like healthcare professionals, like should have the most status and money in our society. But there's something that if you can, it's a beautiful gift for the world if you have that capacity and drive to, not everyone has that drive to create, you know?
Yeah. And it's that the reason we exalt them is that they're bringing us a taste of Eden. That's really what they're doing. And we want those tastes. I mean, we would like to live there all the time. Talking about psychology for a second, mainstream psychology, I kind of knew in advance that I believe there was this distinction between melancholy and depression that the field of psychology wasn't talking about. What I didn't realize and came to see is that I think that because most psychologists are atheists or agnostics, and I'm an agnostic myself, but because most psychologists are this, we don't properly talk about spirituality in psychology. Like, we think of it as, I'm saying we as if I'm a psychologist. I'm sort of in the field as a writer.
You're in the club.
but spirituality gets talked about as if it's like a characteristic that's over here and some people have it and some people don't. You know, you look at the list of character strengths, and for some people, spirituality is high on the list, for others, not at all. And I have come to believe that's a misunderstanding of what spirituality is, and that instead, what is accurate and true is that all humans have this longing for the better, more perfect world, and that one manifestation of that is to long for Mecca or Eden or Zion or the beloved of the soul or whatever you call it. And for other people, it takes completely different manifestation that we express in more secular terms. But still, the heart of the human soul is that longing and that sense of disconnection from the world as we wish it were, the world we feel we belong to. And I think many truths flow from that central premise. So I would like to, I'd like to see what happens if we use that as an organizing principle in psychology. I just want to give credit to Jean Houston. I'm not sure if you say Houston or Houston, but she talks a lot about this idea. And so I just want to give credit where it's due. She talks about this in her books.
Thank you. I appreciate you doing that. I remember in the early days of the book idea and concept, the whole thing was surrounding a concept that you referred to me as existential longing. Now, I loved it, but that's not the central foci. Like, you don't even use that exact phrase in your TED Talk. You say, use the word longing, but I don't think I heard you say existential longing. What happened to that phrase? Because I loved it.
I don't know. I mean, I'm going to turn this to you for a second. What do you think the phrase existential longing gives us that plain longing does not?
Well, if I add the word existential to any word, it gives me something.
Yeah. What is the thing it gives you?
Now I have to articulate what that thing gives me besides a feeling. Like, existential psychotherapy gives me something above and beyond just psychotherapy, right? Mm-hmm. With existential psychotherapy, it's all about understanding, what does it mean to be an experientially alive human? What are the factors and things we can do that make us feel fully human, addressing all of our needs, but our spiritual needs as well, and not neglecting those needs, but also, of course, not neglecting the lower needs. What does it mean to feel like a whole person? Existential longing does seem like it adds something to me than just longing. I can long for that delicious pizza that I had when I was 12 years old. You can long for lots of things that aren't existential.
Right. Okay.
It does seem like there's a boundary condition. where when you long for things that were existential to your whole being, that's what you're longing for. So it really added something to me.
Yeah. Well, that's very persuasive. And maybe I should bring it back into the way I talk about it. I like that.
Susan's bringing existential longing back. That's a play on a Justin Timberlake song. Yeah. What do you say?
I said credit to SBK.
No. Not at all. I'm just reflecting a mirror back on you. Because do you remember, like, we had text messages.
Three years ago, two years ago. We've been talking about this for years and years.
And you use that phrase, and I was like, I love it. Okay, so existential longing and just bittersweetness, the complexities of it, how do you see it differentiate it from the experience of awe? A-W-E. I have trouble saying that word out loud. Awe, and wonder.
I knew what you meant. I do believe they are very close cousins of
their
cousins. Yeah. And in fact, we found in our quiz that people who are predisposed to experiencing these states of bittersweetness also tend to be predisposed to states of awe and wonder and so on. So they're very closely connected. I would say that bittersweetness has that element of sorrow in it. Understanding that everything is impermanent, you know, that which you are gazing upon that is putting you into this state of awe and wonder will not last. And that maybe that's part of the reason you're feeling the awe and wonder in the first place is because it's infused with its impermanence. So it's a recognition of those states. To go back to the existential idea, there's more of an existential question to bittersweetness. Whereas I think awe and wonder we could experience as, you know, just sort of like a passing phenomenon and not one that has the same profound implications.
The all experience can certainly feel profound.
Yeah, that's true.
But you're often witnessing something very outside of yourself and you're kind of in reverence of it. Whereas bittersweetness is not the same thing as reverence or even, you know, fear. It is something more deeply existential. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, the reverence might trigger it, but it's more about the longing to go home at its base. It's like a longing for some fundamental home. And it might be triggered by beauty or by awe or whatever. But at its base, there's a fundamental pain of separation to being human and a longing for that, for reunion. And that's what bittersweetness is.
When we feel something bittersweet, do we always actually want to return to the thing? Because it seems to me like we can have the bittersweet feeling and yet also cognitively not want to return back. For instance, when I visit like my old high school, or I visit like the high school is probably a bad example because there's not any longing there at all. Let me think of a better example. When I go back to England, let's actually have a proper example. When I go to England and I visit my Cambridge, like where I had my grad school days, there were some of the most wonderful moments in my life. And I feel this kind of bittersweet feeling when I visit it again, and it kind of activates some of those same emotions and feelings. Mm-hmm. But I don't actually want to. So some things are best when they're only experienced once or twice.
Yes.
Sometimes when you try to go back a third time, you're like, no, it wasn't meant, like, it's not the same thing, you know? And so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying? So,
I know exactly. Yeah, no. And I don't mean it in the literal sense. Like I don't mean you literally like want to repeat the past over and over again. I'm not talking about, like there's this one quote, I have it in the book. I read this, I just kind of could not believe that someone had actually managed to articulate the following feeling. Let me see if I can find it. It's in a novel by a guy named Mark Merlis. And he is describing the feeling, we've all experienced this, when you meet somebody like erotically irresistible. And he's saying that when you look at that person who you find so irresistible, maybe I'll just quote him. And this is from a gay novel. So it's written by a man speaking about another man, just to put it all in context. He's saying, do you know how sometimes you see a man and you're not sure if you want to get in his pants or if you want to cry? not because you can't have him, maybe you can, but you see right away something in him beyond having. You can't screw your way into it any more than you can get at the golden eggs by slitting the goose. So you want to cry, not like a child, but like an exile who is reminded of his homeland. And that's what character A saw when he first beheld character B, as if he were getting a glimpse of that other place we were meant to be, the shore from which we were deported before we were born. So that's what I'm talking about.
That's beautiful, but I really need to wrap my head around it more than that.
Okay.
Because, well, what is it that you are longing for there specifically? I can relate to the feeling of seeing someone so beautiful for me, because I have my own quirky tastes. Maybe other my friends will be like, bro, really, her? And I'm like, no, trust me, her, you know. But someone so beautiful to me, I can relate to that feeling of feeling like, yeah, like, I don't know about crying, but like no matter what I do in the mortal world, it'll not be enough union with that person. Just like, you know, they use the word screwing, but making love, no matter how much making love, you know, I'd be doing with that person. I still it still there not be a full completeness because that person is such perfection in my eyes. Now, so there is kind of an I think I kind of get it, but what is the longing there? Can you articulate it?
Yeah, it's like in that moment, the person represents something beyond that which is attainable in this world, and I guess I'm saying that is a fundamental part of our being, that a full union is not attainable in this world, but the act of longing for it brings us ever closer, kind of like an asymptote, and it expresses itself through acts of creativity and through acts of love.
Yeah, I do tend to be utopic. I have, you know, I tend to think along those lines, even in my own theory of whole love that I propose in my book Transcend. It's what does it look like when all these things are integrated with a partner, and what does whole love look like? And I don't know if it's obtainable. It's probably not attainable, but the idea is that there is some sort of ideal that we are deeply longing for. Is this kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I would say so. I actually think it's useful in our real life love relationships to understand these dynamics and to accept that the person who we're with and the person who we love is not going to deliver us back to Eden, you know, and that what often happens in the course of a typical love relationship is that at the very beginning of it, when you're first uniting, you actually feel for some moment in time or moments in time that together you've achieved this thing that the human soul longs for. And then, of course, real life intervenes in the form of incompatibilities and so on that any two humans coming together are going to have. And then, you know, if we're not aware of these dynamics, you might turn to your partner and be like, wait, what the heck? This wasn't Eden after all. Now I better go look for another person who might deliver me there. And of course, that doesn't really get you anywhere. So I actually think it's very helpful. It's healthy to understand the way we are programmed this way and to appreciate, you know, in the course of any relationship, you're going to keep having those moments where you feel like, oh my gosh, we're getting back to that amazing place. And to know it can keep generating that way, but it's not always going to be. It's not all the time going to be that way.
It's very good to have a realistic view as well of other people and not put people on pedestals. That can lead to psychological disorders. Yeah, when you do splitting, you know, with people. So yeah, but also holding at the same time holding in mind this emotion of existential longing is still valuable.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and so like all my life, I've loved Leonard Cohen. I talk about this in the book. I think I'm obsessed with him my whole life. And I never really understood what it was about his music that spoke to me so much, you know. And then it was after he died, I started reading about him and I heard interviews with his son and so on. And he this music came out of this idea. It was based on the Kabbalah, the mystical side of Judaism. And the idea, well, the metaphor of the Kabbalah is that all of creation once was a divine unity, and then it shattered. And so now we're living in a kind of broken world where the shards of the divine are scattered all around us. They're like strewn around us, and our job is to pick them up wherever we might happen to see one. And so all of his music that I was reacting to all those years was about this idea of beautiful brokenness, you know, the fact that everything is simultaneously broken and beautiful. And also, like, the way his son talks about his music, he says that, like, he had this perception that this was reality, but that, like, then he would create these songs whose purpose was to be a kind of transcendence delivery machine. Like he said, the way cigarettes deliver nicotine to you, his songs were for the purpose of delivering transcendence through this medium. And that's what creativity can be at its best. I think that's what we're often doing when we perform a creative act.
I agree. I have often felt not completely at home with being a scientist. Because I like writing, and I like writing being a vehicle to inspire and to have people experience the feeling of transcendence. I actually want people to read my books and feel transcendence when they read my books. Mm-hmm. That's a different kind of longing than a lot of scientists have.
Yeah.
pure scientists, right?
No, I understand that.
Being able to integrate those sides of me, which I feel like I did in my book Transcend. I feel like it gave me an opportunity to really be, you know, unabashed in saying, hey, I like transcendence. Hey, that's the title of the book.
Yeah.
And also saying, hey, let's look at the science and see what it says about how we can have more transcendence. That was a really nice way for me to finally find a way, a sneaky way of integrating it all, you know. But
I don't think it's sneaky. I think it was very on its face. That's what you were doing. And it seems to me that science, and specifically psychology, has more appetite for that or more license for that than it used to. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, thanks to people like David Yeadon, and thanks to people like Dr. Keltner and people who are really studying the science of transcendence, and Andy Newberg, putting it on a firm foundation, a firm neurological and behavioral foundation, where it's not treated as though it's an indicator of mental illness, because Freud certainly thought these self-transcendent moments were infantile regressions to the womb.
Right.
What does that even mean?
I know.
But that's what he saw these things as. He would say bittersweetness is, well, he said that was his just everything. It was like, that wasn't like sex or violence, was infantile regressions to the womb.
Yeah, no, and the oceanic experience was nonsense. Yeah. I know. I love Dr. Keltner's work. I actually spent a whole chapter talking about it. His work, especially on the compassionate instinct and the way that human beings, because we are primed to respond to the cries of infants, that what radiates from there is that we're also primed to respond to the cries of all beings in distress. And obviously we're not perfect at that. And we have lots of limitations, but I love his studies about the vagus nerve, you know, the big, gigantic bundle of nerves in our bodies, which are responsible for our most basic functions, like breathing and digestion, and that also react when we see another being in distress. Yes. To me, the fact that it's that basic and that ancient a bodily system that governs this ability to, not just ability, but like a tendency to see sadness, to notice it, and to respond with love, that's pretty profound. You know, and I don't remember if it was Deck or someone else who said we tend to think of these emotions as being Sunday school emotions, you know, that are like, we're taught we're supposed to feel these things, but maybe they're not quite true. So to have this whole body of work that builds the case for it from the ground up is so valuable.
Yeah, it's so valuable. And yeah, I'm excited about the new science of self-transcendence. Everything has to be the new science for it to like count, you know, in terms of publicity materials. But no, I'm really excited about it. You did quite a bit of research and traveling while you're doing this book. Mm-hmm. One thing that I want to talk about was a conference you went to, a conference of transhumanists.
Yes.
Who hope to live forever. Yeah. What did you learn about bittersweetness from talking to them?
Well, that whole inquiry, that was very interesting, and it really challenged a lot of my assumptions in ways that I'm still grappling with, because, you know, this is a collection of people who believe that we can and will ultimately live, you know, if not forever, healthy lives, that we can extend our health span for hundreds upon hundreds of years at some point. And they ask really interesting questions, like, you know, let's say the standard philosophical assumption is that it's our mortality that helps to give our life meaning, let's say, you know, and that impermanence is what, that the knowledge of impermanence gives us a greater sense of the preciousness of life. And these things are true, I believe. At the same time, you know, I talked to some of these people at this conference, and they would say things like, you know, those are all stories that we tell ourselves because we feel we have no choice but to die. And so if you truly have no choice, then of course you're going to want to give yourself as beautiful and reassuring a story as you possibly can. But if you knew you didn't have to, and your beloveds didn't have to die, you would no longer be telling yourself that quote story. And that is a very persuasive argument. At the same time, that we have not only the philosophers, but on the other hand, people like Laura Carstensen at Stanford, who studies aging and longevity and so on. She gave a famous TED talk called Older People Are Happier. And she's done all this research showing that older people tend to have a greater sense of meaning, a greater sense of gratitude, less likely to have unnecessary anger, like a whole list of traits that we might classify as wisdom. And well, that's been a stereotype for a long time, the idea that age confers wisdom. But what Carstensen found is that it's not age per se that gives wisdom. It's having an intense sense of life's fragility that gives it. And so she found that young people who, for whatever life circumstance, had been primed to realize how fragile life is, that those young people had the same sense of wisdom that the older people did.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that does get to a very profound truth that we all sense. You know, it's like the reason we love cherry blossoms the way we do. Like, why do we have festivals in their honor? Like, it's not only that they're beautiful, it's that they don't live very long. They're a symbol of fragility.
Wow. What kind of tree lives the longest?
I don't know. I guess redwoods live for hundreds of years, don't they? And we love them too. We love them in a different way.
Or in all of them. Yeah, in a different way.
We love them differently.
Yeah.
But they don't live forever. You know, hundreds of years is a blip. So, but I do think there's something about their strength and solidity that is very, very comforting and magisterial. I mean, so I'm not saying fragility and bittersweetness is the only type of beauty and power. I'm just saying it's like one type that we tend not to pay attention to.
I'm reflecting on Abraham Maslow's near end of death, the very end of his life.
Yes.
He was walking on the beach and he wrote in his personal diary, because yes, I read 1,000 pages of his personal diaries. and he wrote, it's the contrast between the eternal nature of the waves and the mortality of my being that creates the highest height of transcendence for me.
Wow. Yeah.
It was the contrast of the two. I don't know how I'm linking this to what you're saying, but...
Oh, it's completely linked. Just, I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he also said, right, that it was in the final months of his life after he had had, it was a heart attack.
He already had a big heart attack, yeah.
Yeah, that he experienced the greatest sense of transcendence and meaning. Isn't that right?
100%. 100%
yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
He wrote that he realized it wasn't the peak experience that was the greatest beauty and transcendence in life. It was what he called the plateau experience, which is being able to see the miraculous in the everyday.
Right.
He said that was more transcendent to him than the peaks that he had been chasing his whole life and which so many people seek, you know, and which he had written about so much in his life. So a lot of people are not aware of the plateau experience. Now, is that the best naming for it from a publicity point of view?
No. It's the wrong name. I think you should rename it.
Yeah, it's the existential longing experience.
Yeah, it is. And it's a kind of contrast experience too.
Yeah.
But yeah, contending with a transhumanist or immortalist or whatever word one uses, contending with that argument, it's very, very interesting. Like one of the people who I met with, a guy named Keith Kamita, who I really respect, such a good guy, who's doing all this work to extend our health spans. He did a thought experiment with me where he said, okay, would you want to die tomorrow? No, I wouldn't. Okay, would you want to die next week? No. Would you want to die, you know, 10 years from now? No. Well, what about the day after that, or the day after that, or the day after that? And you start to realize as you do this thought experiment that it's hard to envision the day that you would ever, if you could, like push the button and say, now it's time to go. And that it's very hard to answer that question.
Yeah, so true.
I guess the best answer that I've come up with to that is, like, you know, God bless the transhumanists for working on all this stuff. The whole idea of the preciousness that's embodied in fragility is a response to the world as it is. You know, if one day the world totally transforms into something else, then maybe the theory will still hold and maybe it won't. But for the next hundreds of years, this is the world we have. Yeah. And in that world, this bittersweetness and this existential longing, I believe, is one of our great superpowers. So that's how I square the circle of what the transhumanists are doing and my philosophy.
What about the work you did learning from bereavement counselors, like in The Art of Dying?
Well, I mean, what really came out of that experience, I talk in the book about how I went to this conference, as you say, for bereavement counselors. I am not a bereavement counselor myself. I was like a person writing about this stuff. And we all had to go around the room and share an experience of loss. And I shared my story and I found myself like in floods of tears, embarrassingly. So like much more than anybody else in the room who had shared. And because of that, that led to a deep conversation with the amazing guy who was leading the seminar. His name is Simcha Raphael. He does a lot of work with bereavement and death and so on. He's a death counselor, I think he calls himself. And
wow.
And he kind of diagnosed me, for lack of a better word, as suffering from a kind of inherited grief that I inherited through the generations of trauma of my family that had come before me. And you and I talked about this, actually. Like that sent me down a whole pathway of looking at the research on inherited grief and whether it's transmitted only culturally and familially, or whether it's also transmitted epigenetically. And I tend to think it's all three. And the epigenetic evidence, it's early, but it's really pretty fascinating, the various studies that have been done by people like Rachel Yehuda, who have looked at the transmission, epigenetic transmission, children of Holocaust survivors. She's also looking now at grandchildren too. But then you also see it in these crazy mice studies, you know, where you have like, you take one traumatized mouse and have it mate and then remove it from the cage. So remove it from the community. So it's no longer influencing its fellow mice on a behavioral level. It's gone. But six generations later, you see the descendants of the traumatized mouse exhibiting the same symptoms of having been traumatized. So like there was something that seems to have been passing. Understanding all that, it's like, it's fascinating. It's validating to people who feel they've experienced it. And I think it's also liberating, because once you suspect that this might be at play in your own history, there are different ways of like absorbing that knowledge and transforming it into something that you can really live with and experience with some beauty.
Yeah. And it can even be a guide for self-actualization, dare I say, because, yeah. You know, I'm a, I'm creating this form of coaching. I'm calling self-actualization coaching, and I'm creating a program, a whole training program for it. And I would love to incorporate some of your ideas into it. I would love to, in particular, you said something that really hit. Again, you said a lot of things that hit in your TED Talk and in your book. But something that really hit, you said, follow your longing.
Yeah.
I would modify, say, follow your existential longing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a really deep, profound, there's deep, profound wisdom there on as a guide to how to really self-actualize in your life, and is not running away from those longings, but actually following them. And it's just so beautiful. Did you want to elaborate a little at all on what you meant by follow your longing?
Yeah, I guess I'll give you two examples of it. You know, one in terms of inherited grief for a second before you kind of go out from there. There's this masterpiece of a song by the musician Dara Williams, and it's called After All. And she talks about how she had fallen into, this is all in the song. It's like a storytelling song. And it talks about how she had fallen into a depression, and she started realizing that the only way out was to travel down what she calls the whispering well of her family. And so she starts learning about what her mother had been through, and what her father had been through, and the generations. And then she comes back up out of the well, and suddenly the world is bright and full of colors again.
Mm.
And she does this all really beautifully, but it is a way of showing how not turning away from these things, but instead like diving into them with full knowledge of what they are, can rescue us, and can also transform them into, she said, it worked me over like a work of art. That's the line in the song, that process had worked her over like a work of art. And then I'll also, if you want, I'll tell you a story of how longing was like the great self-actualizing force in my life. Do you want to hear the story?
Yes, please. Yes, please.
Okay. I guess I alluded to it in the TED Talk, but
a bad boy artist you got obsessed with.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess we're coming to the end, so I'll try to give you a shortened version. But, you know, I had wanted to be a writer since I was 4. I had totally forgotten about that and became a corporate lawyer and practiced law for almost a decade. Got really ambitious about it, wanted to make partner until the day came that basically, I found out I wasn't making partner, and I left the firm like that very day, and also at the same time left a relationship that had always felt long. It was a 7-year relationship. So like I'm suddenly in my early 30s and I'm floating around with no career and no love, and I don't have a place to live. Yeah. And I fall into this relationship with a lyricist and musician and very lit up person who I've developed like a crazy obsession for. And I could not shake myself from this obsession. It was simultaneously the best and the worst feeling in the world. And I had this friend, Naomi, and I would tell her every time I saw her, I'm sure I'd bored her silly with stories of this guy. And then one day she said to me, if you were this obsessed with him, it's because he represents something you are longing for. So it's not him. It's like, what are you longing for that he represents to you? And it was so clear. It was like instantly I knew, well, he was representing the world of writing and art that I had wanted to be a part of since I was 4 years old and had gone on this massive detour in the wrong direction. And as soon as she said that and I had that realization, the obsession was gone. It was gone. And I know that sounds too cinematic to believe, but truly it was gone. And I just started writing. And I still loved him, but not like that. You know, the obsessive quality was no longer. Yeah. And I've not really
looked at it. The power over you. Yeah. The power over you disappeared.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was a case of just following my longing. And I promise you, I had no idea at that moment that I could ever make a living from being a writer. It was just that I then organized my life around writing. And that was enough to satisfy the longing.
Susan, wow. This was so great chatting with you. And I just want to thank you so much for coming back on my psychology podcast and for just keeping it soulful. You know, you keep keeping it soulful. And I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, SPK. I'm sure that is no small explanation of why we've been friends for such a long time. The desire to keep it soulful. So thank you for all you do and have been doing, and I have been watching it all for years with so much excitement and happiness for you. So thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.